Welcome to the Fundamentalist Podcast, everybody.
We can add more clapping and
we'll add more clapping. We'll sweeten the clapping. Don't worry. Welcome, everybody. My name is Elliot. This is Pete. This is the Fundamentalist Podcast. If you're listening, this is the first ever live event that we've done here at Central Avenue Church in Glendale, California. And thank you to Aaron, who is the pastor here, for hosting this. And this is a podcast where we talk about life and how to deal with it and all the fun ups and downs of it and how right is left and left is right. And we have wine and beer here. The wine specifically is brought to you by a thing called Wink, or W-I-N-C, and you can get some of that wine for free at trywink.com/fundamentalist. You don't have to type in the grunt. So the way this works is we're going to do a little order of service. I'm going to basically hand off the subject matter to Pete, which, have you mentioned what it is yet?
No.
Cool. Okay. No. So we're going to talk about what we're going to talk about. Pete's going to, you know, do his little thing, and then we're gonna talk about life, and it should be really interesting. So Pete, take it away.
Okay, well, we're gonna talk about castration.
Castration, everybody.
Yes, there we go. Castration.
In case you were worried I didn't do enough penis jokes. Okay.
Yeah. Castration, I'm gonna just talk a little bit about what castration means in psychoanalysis, and then we're gonna take it from there.
Great.
So castration, it's weird that we use that word. I'm just a psychoanalytic theorist. I don't do practice. But why do psychoanalysts use the word castration?
I don't practice castration.
I don't practice castration, yes. It is, castration basically means separation from the thing that will make you whole and complete. Right? Castration has come to mean the sense of loss that is central to being human. So this idea that there is something that might complete me, whether it's in religion, whether it's money, whether it's in another person, and everywhere around us, in sacred and secular ways, there are people promising wholeness and completeness. And castration is simply a name for the inability to have that. And there is a thing called the non-castrated other, which is the fantasy that there are other people out there who have it, and we don't. So we look at other people, and they seem like they've got an incredible life, they've got it all together, and we often hate them for it. And and LA is incredible for this. I mean, everywhere you walk, like, there's people who are looking so cool, look like they've got their lives together.
Thank you.
Yeah, there you go. And it's actually a whole system that is rigged to create that. I knew some people in LA. I talked to one particular person who was a director, and he was lent, I think it was a Range Rover, some really fancy car. It was really nice, and he was driving around in it, but he had no money. He was living with his mum, and he was just lent this car by the company because they wanted, you know, his image with the car.
So cool, man.
He's playing this game. He looks like this guy who's got it all together, but as soon as you scratch beneath the surface, it's not there. I often go to Deus Ex Machina, if you know that coffee shop in Venice. And I remember there was this person there who always looked so together, always looked, she was so cool. She had all these cool friends. And I always imagined that she had this life that was just incredible. And I remember months later going back to Deus and talking to some of the staff, and they told me that tragically she had taken her life. And I was shocked. I never knew her. I didn't know who she was. I just knew she kind of worked there from time to time and she hung out with people. But in my mind, she had it all together. She was this non-castrated other. But in reality, she was struggling with lots of things that I didn't know anything about, and many of her closest friends didn't know anything about. You see it also in Hollywood movies as well. So the baddie is always somebody who's got excessive pleasure, like the Joker, who's got a smile etched on his face. So that's a kind of fantasy that we have. And in relation to what I was sharing earlier and what Elliot was sharing earlier, when we often create images of ourselves, ideals, we act as if we've got it all together. We act as if things are good. we can pretend to ourselves. Have you heard of Instagram, right? You know, we pretend to ourselves and to other people that our lives are great. We're not lying to them so much as we're lying to ourselves. And yet there are times in our lives when something happens that disrupts that image, which tells us that we are not the thing that we think we are. And it's that experience when you realize you're an idiot, or you realize that you're not your carefully curated image, that you experience this idea of castration. So there you go. There's a definition.
Peter Rollins, everybody.
Yeah.
You know?
Thank you. Yeah.
Pretty neat. Pretty neat. I bet you never thought about castration like that. Yeah. You know? Yeah. It's pretty, you made it fun. And that's the cool part. Yeah. Yeah, man, that's a why did we decide on castration?
That's a good question.
Nah.
Exactly. Why is it called that? It's kind of like, right, you use the word atom in science. So atom means an indivisible molecule, a building bricks of civilization and the universe. But of course we know we can split the atom now. So the atom comes from like the kind of ancient Greek philosophers, Democritus and Lysicris, I think, who were originally theorizing about the building blocks of the universe. Now, the way we understand the word atom is so different from the way the ancient Greeks understood the idea of atom.
Because
they're dumb, yes. But there is some sort of continuity. It's a minimal continuity, and the continuity is held in the word. And in the same way, castration is kept because really, weirdly, the reflections on this started by how kids looked at their genitals and other people's genitals. They either had a penis or didn't. And then there was lots of work on like how kids reacted to that knowledge. Yeah.
That's still basically just my criteria for when I'm...
Yeah.
Dating girls.
No penis is a prerequisite. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's good. That's
one
your line.
One of those is a green light and one of them tends to be a red light, and that's just all there is to it.
Yeah. You're a simple man with simple tastes.
Simple man, simple taste.
Yeah.
Pete.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's where it started. But then, of course, it went way beyond that, and now it's nothing to do with that at all. But those original reflections on biologically how kids responded to fear of losing their penis, or I don't have a penis because the penis is obviously visible as the genitals that are visible. So
you're saying that the word came because children were scared when they didn't see a penis?
Thank
you for coming tonight, everybody.
Yeah. There was reflections on, like, weirdly, I don't know if it happens anymore. I don't know if any of your parents and ever threaten to castrate your kids if they're bad. That kind of stuff used to happen.
Yeah, you know.
There was certain castration anxiety, and then somebody else might go, I don't have one of those. And there was all of this stuff that was around that.
That's the epistemology. Is that the right word? The history of the word? That's what you're explaining where the word comes from.
Where the word comes from, where the research comes from. But now it's completely not to do with that.
Yeah.
But they keep the word because that's kind of where this notion of losing something, yeah, and the anxiety of the loss all arrived from.
Yeah, I think the term the fantasy of the non-castrated other just is one of the coolest phrases that I've heard you say.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, that and whatever you were saying about Seamus.
Yes,
pretty cool. Yeah, we were talking before the podcast, and one of the, what this reminded me of was an experience that I'm currently going through where it was on Sunday, and like there was a girl and and we got into like a thing, like a spat and what have you, and I basically got real pissy about the whole thing, and then on Sunday she was like, what's going on? And I was like, here's everything that's going on. I was like, you know, this is what my therapist says, you know, just say everything. And then you see where the cards, you know, fall where they may or whatever. And I was like, okay, this can't go bad. And so I said everything. And I was like, this is the thing, this is the thing. And okay, so basically what happened was, like last week, she maybe got a little upset that I wasn't doing a particular thing called Making the Bed. And so I didn't make the bed. And then in my mind, I was like, well, I don't make the bed. Like, if I make the bed, I make the bed, you know, out of my own volition. Because if I do it and you just want me to do it, then it's transactional and I'm not doing it out of love. And if I'm not doing it out of love, and then in my mind, I was like, well, this is what's going to happen. I'm not going to be a free person anymore. And then I'm going to have all these expectations. And then it's not going to be fun anymore. And the relationship's going to go down the drain. This must mean that I'm not supposed to be with this person. And so all these like fears are playing in my head. But then also, I was like, I know, you know, I know.
Can you imagine living with this, by the way? This is terrifying.
Yeah, it is kind of like that. Yeah. It's like 6 a.m. Whatever, dude. Okay, I come out at like 6 a.m. in the morning and Pete's pacing. Like, it's almost like you're pretending to be a philosopher at like 6 a.m. You walk around like oh, you know, what is this? You know, and I'm like, what do you do? You already know. So anyway, I basically was like, I had this whole like monologue that I gave to the girl about all of these anxieties and all this stuff, and I was saying where I was and where I wanted to be and blah blah blah, and she was like, cool, bye. And then I was like, oh! And then I like lost it, and like I tend to be a robotic human being, and I just lost it emotionally. I was crying and I was like, no, I didn't mean, you know, this, and it was very shocking and very like weird and pitiful. And basically, I think if I can relate in any way to castration, I think what was happening was like, in my mind, I was like, well, I have it, you know, very figured out. And like, this is how it is. Like I've read like 7 self-help books and like, I know kind of like what's up. And in that moment, I did not expect the emotional like freak out, but then it was like, oh, then it was like all this stuff that I like thought I knew and all these ideas that I had about like, well, you know, if you do that, then like blah, 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 blah. All of that was like, oh my God, how stupid and so petty and dumb. Like, can you imagine what kind of asshole is like, would be like, I don't know how she put up with me at all. And then I told Pete about it and Pete was like, well, you know, he was basically like, the bed could, you know, for her represent kind of like her or, you know, the relationship itself. And there, you know, for when you didn't do that, it was a sign of disregard. And I was like, yeah, but this is about me, you know. And anyway, it basically just like revealed in the, you know, the past 4 days what a little turd I can be. And so that's where I'm at. And now I'm like in this like, I don't, you know, like I definitely thought I had the whole thing figured out, and then I said everything, which is what my therapist said to do, and sure enough, it knocked me into, you know, the state of...
The fundamentalist is basically free therapy for Elliot.
Yeah.
You've just been invited along to listen to all of his issues.
Yeah, it's just double therapy.
Yeah, it's double therapy.
It's very sad.
But what Elliot experienced in this moment, because you're very chilled out, you're very together, whatever, but this experience rocked you. Yeah, but it kind of like suddenly it destabilized you. That's what this whole the other dimension does. It's like, that's why it's so threatening, is it, you have an image of yourself as I'm together, I don't really care that much, you know, I could take or leave this relationship,
yeah.
I could, you know, maybe it'll work, maybe it won't, all of those things, but you know, but suddenly it gets taken away and you break down.
Well,
that's a surprise, but it was a surprise.
Yeah, it was definitely a surprise and a sad one. I also think there's a thing that happens where, like, I imagine many of you guys have grown up in some kind of like religious environment, you know, for sure. And and I think what happens, at least in my experience, is it's very easy to like see things on such a macro level and such like a grandiose kind of like, well, this is really what's happening here. And I can get real into like too into psych, like I can get lost in the weeds. And then like, there are these moments that happen where it's like, all that stuff just flies out the window and I just become this kid who just lost something that he didn't know he had. And like, there's like, that's like the real, I feel like that's the actual real life stuff, even though I mean, you know, what? I don't know what'll happen. I don't know what could happen, and we'll find out. But like, I feel like those are the things that we miss when we spend a lot of time getting so obsessed with like a lot. Because I don't know, maybe it's just me, but I mean, we do this podcast.
Well, the bed thing's interesting. Okay, so here's the thing about the bed. He doesn't make the bed a couple... Can I talk about this?
Twice.
Okay. He doesn't make the bed twice. So you go, okay.
Out of 4,000 times. No.
but you go, what if... And I don't know this person. I'm not sure. But what if they feel that you're going into their life, you know...
I don't like what you're...
you know, you're going into their life when you want. You stay there, and then you leave and disregard what you leave behind.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. That's exactly what it is. Yeah.
But what if that person then can't, they don't know that themselves. They can't articulate that themselves. So they don't even know. So the bed is the symbol that tells the truth that can't be spoken. Yeah. So the bed becomes the truth that is unspeakable, you know.
Guess I'll take some questions now.
Yeah. So when you also but when you get annoyed about saying I have to make the bed, you're also potentially going, I don't know if I want to commit myself at that level.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're saying, I, you know, so all of that's being spoken.
I'm defending in some way, keeping everything at an arm's distance.
So everything is communicated through the unmade bed.
This is not shining me in a good light. When we were on the way here, I was like, yeah, man, I had this this dream the other night where this happened and this happened and this happened. And I was just like, oh, this is interesting. And I didn't think anything would come of it. And then Pete to himself just starts going, okay, you were in a kitchen. It wasn't your kitchen. You saw each other. You said this. You said hi. You said that. And I was like, oh, yeah, psychic. Let me know what it is. And this is, you know, basically... I mean, I'm no treat to live with, but imagine if everything you did was, like if every single thing was like, well, you know, it could be, you know, you're... Yeah.
Now, by the way, I know what you're thinking. I think this too, like this, it can't work like this, right? It can't work like this. It's ridiculous. Like this idea...
It is a little extreme, yeah.
It's a little extreme. But then I know someone who last week had a dream about a baby goat who was pissing everywhere, causing all of this disaster in this place, and I was running around, right? And it wasn't me who interpreted it, it was somebody else I know, but was like, okay, well, a baby goat's a kid, and you're married, and you've been talking about having children, and you're going like, it's not a far stretch to think that you're terrified of a kid who's going to mess up your life. That doesn't mean that's the truth, but it's like, these dreams, it's weird how when you start to look out for it, we tell the truth all the time. That's why Freud said, when you really look at people, you would think that they can't lie. You think that it's impossible for people to lie, because even if they tell you falsities with their mouth, and they always do, they will tell you the truth through the tapping of their finger. They always, everyone's telling the truth all the time.
Did y'all just stop tapping your fingers? That all you
Yeah. Yeah. But that's what I mean by the wholly other dimension that speaks, that tremors within us, that that we try to ignore because it will destabilize our lives. But the more we ignore it, the more the symptoms erupt.
I also just wish, like, I feel like at some point...
This seemed like a good idea at the time, by the way, these ridiculous mugs. No, I'm drinking my wine.
Every time I feel like a king. It's the coolest. And also... Bob, the IPA, the hazy IPA is so wonderful. The wine went into Pete's eye, but the hazy IPA is amazing. Anyway, yeah, I feel like at this point, I don't know, there's a frustration that happens because I feel like I'm 31, and this is going to be the most naive sounding thing, but I was like, I'm supposed to have it figured out by now. And then, like, I read the 7 books or the 8 books or whatever, and, like, then stuff like this happens. And I guess this just happens till we die. Is that the plan? We just constantly, we got it figured out. Something happens. You cry in your bed. You didn't realize you like the girl as much as you do. And then you question everything. And then your psychoanalyst roommate tells you that the bed represented what you were resenting the entire time. And now you have to retroactively fix everything. This is the end of days.
This is the end of days. But here's the good news. There is good news. There is good news, right? The bad news is, I love that, right? So symptom. The traditional, old-fashioned way of spelling symptom is S-I-N-T-H-O-M-E. And in French, it's symptôme. So the psychoanalyst Lacan, the theorist Lacan, he uses symptôme. Symptôme in French is holy man, symptôme. Holy man is a prophet. So what does a prophet do? A prophet speaks truth. And what happens if you ignore a prophet?
That's good.
Well, disaster happens. But what happens if you listen to a prophet? Well, good things can happen. So your symptom is your santhom, is your prophet, speaking a truth that you do not want to address. But if you ignore that truth, things get worse. But if you somehow open yourself up to that dimension, it doesn't make your life wonderful, but it makes things a little bit better. And so it's like there's no, the holy other dimension never disappears. It's how do you make space for it in your life? How do you find a way to once a week or once a month or whatever it is, have space to listen to your parapraxis? And if you do that, then good things happen.
Just so I'm clear, again, how exactly, loop back in the castration stuff.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Because I feel like we got lost into that bed stuff, and I was like, you just make the bed of it. But like,
well, so there's two ways of avoiding castration, kind of like it's being and having, right? So some people pretend to have the thing that makes them whole and complete, and some people pretend to be the thing. Now, in our society, often but not exclusively, and also this is just contingently, but often women will be more prone to being the object and men having the object. So sometimes you will find a man saying, I have the job, I have the money, I have the car, I have all of this stuff, I have the thing. And sometimes what women are placed into is the position of saying, I am the thing. So I am the thing that will make you whole and complete. Oh yeah, but both of these are fictions. They are fictions that we play with and fictions that are useful fictions sometimes. But they are attempts for us to avoid realizing that we are castrated. But the more we avoid the reality that we are castrated, the more we will have symptoms that will be destructive.
Well, I have no symptoms that are destructive, Pete, and I don't appreciate you implying that. basically, so what this reminded me of is, so we share a lovely home together, Pete and I, and I wear the pants, and basically what we've talked about this a lot, where it's like we will go back and forth and be like, this is really nice, like we have a fun, like it's very fun for me, like it's a fun experience, like I get to live with Pete, I've read Pete's books, I look up to him, so it's like a very cool experience to do that. And then what'll happen is, like you're saying, like I'm this like chilled out guy or whatever, and so then there's this like temptation, or like even this like trickery that I fool myself into, where it's like, oh no, like the, like you're saying, like the guy being like, oh, he has this and he has that, and like I feel like I live this life where it's like, no, I have it, like I'm good, like I'm okay and I'm happy and things are great, and like then people are like, well, you seem sad, and I'm like, no, I'm not, and then like, but then everybody says that, and I'm like, maybe I am, and so basically, and then stuff like this, you know, weekend happens, and I think there's something to it where it's like there's an inclination to be like, everything's hunky-dory, and then because it kind of is at times. Like I have very little to complain about comparatively, and I also feel like I was raised in the South and like it was just terrible, and so like I escaped, like how much do I have to complain about? And but at the same time, there's stuff to complain about, and I hesitate to complain about anything or to like reveal or like look at what I'm lacking or look at what is sucking, and I feel that part sucks, and like part of the suckage is the realization that like I can think I have it all figured out, expect people to be exactly like me and see the world like me, which I wouldn't wish upon many people, but in some way I still want it to happen, and then when it doesn't, there's this like the ground falls out from under me, and I don't know what that is, or if that relates to being castrated, but
yeah, well it does, and this is why I moved to LA. Now this isn't really the reason why I moved to LA. It's the way I pretend this is the reason why
the
I moved to LA.
Official answer.
Yes, this is the official answer. The unofficial answer is, one, somebody gave me cheap rent. Two, the weather's nice, and I just love LA. I got to say, I really like it.
It's nice.
But my official answer is that LA is the most religious, one of the religious centers of America, one of the religious centers of the world. That if you define religion as that which promises wholeness and completeness, so that which promises non-castration, then this is the Mecca. Like every street corner, there is a prophet promising wholeness and completeness if you do the right yoga practice, or you join the right thing, or you eat the right, you know, vegan food or whatever, or you do, you know, whatever it is. There's everyone all around are promising. Even this is the word Scientology does well, which is the ultimate religion of, you know, promising to become clear. And what I want to do is bring existential despair to Los Angeles. That's my job. I want to bring freedom from happiness. Freedom from the tyranny of happiness.
Yeah.
And that's what this place needs. So that's why I'm here.
We thank you, Peter. Yeah. Thank you.
My work here is done. And so, but so like, you know, people come to LA, like you came to LA, you know, pursue your dreams of acting and being doing all of that stuff. But you come here and there is a certain sense in which people go like, it's brilliant, it's amazing. But eventually that cracks, and it cracks hard.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know how much.
Yeah, man. Who was I talking to? Was it you? It wasn't. There was someone where it was like that moment where you're like, what am I doing with all of, who gives a crap? Anyway, so yeah, I know what you're talking about. Yeah. That moment of like, this is what I'm still doing. It's horrible.
Yeah.
And it's embarrassing at times. Anyway.
Yeah.
That's sad.
So comedians, and it's funny, like I think comedians are where existentialism still exists within America. So because comedians often talk about the dark stuff and all of that. So comedy is, I think that's why you do comedy. Your comedian friends are important elements too. There's an old tradition in the Jewish tradition that says that you have to have 10 righteous people in a city, and that will like stop it from being destroyed. And I think maybe there's a version that says you have to have 10 comedians in a city.
In Los Angeles.
In Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And that's what keeps it from collapsing into the tyranny of happiness, which is ultimately the black hole of absolute depression. So you're doing good work.
Thanks, Pete. Right. I was dating this girl, and she was very like, we went on like a couple dates, and she was like very very pretty and very pleasant and like, you know, nice. And she was like, I get up every morning at 6 a.m. and I do yoga, and after the yoga I paint, and here are some of my paintings, and I'm gluten-free, and I jog for 2 hours in the afternoon. And I, blah, 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 and she listed, like, she was such a good person that it terrified me. And I was like, well, this is exactly what you want. You want, like, somebody who's, like, got her crap together, and she's, you know, she's got a lot of gumption, and she's got drive, and she does all these cool things, and she's got all these hobbies. And then I was like, I have to get away from this
and
person.
And she kills cats.
Yeah. Yeah. I was like, what is?
There has to be something.
What's the thing?
Yeah.
And then she catfished me. No. I'm
yeah. Kidding. Yeah. That's, I mean, that's perversion, actually. Is that, and not her, I don't know about her, but no. A perverse subject is able to completely integrate into their community as long as they have one crazy transgression that they do. So like in like high end schools in England, you know, like Eton or something like that, everyone is, they're supposed to be intelligent, sophisticated, sober. They're supposed to treat people with respect.
That was her thing. She was sober, like she didn't drink any, which, okay, never mind.
But then you have these secret societies where you get drunk, treat people terribly, do all of that. And so the idea for a perverse subject is they're able to integrate very well into society as long as they have this area of their life that they can kind of go crazy in.
So you, like, I know in my realm of, like, existence that there is the got it all figured out, happy-go-lucky, chilled out, super cool, super, you know, not cool, but, like cool with life type of persona. And then there's the thing that cracks and dies and burns forever. And you've written 17,000 books. You're about to release a film. Are releasing a graphic novel, is it? Or comic?
I think so. I don't know what it's called.
It's a book. It's a book of fairy tales. And it's like, Pete, like, stop being predictable. You know, like, we saw it coming, dude. Finally, get it out of your system. But so you do all this stuff. You have these. You read. You do legitimately. To Pete's credit, just in case you guys are curious, I've never. You know, like, there's always that concern if you were raised in the church of, like, the snake oil salesman and, like, kind of, like, not whatever. Like, you prepare more than Well, for one, you prepare 1,000 times more than I prepare for anything, but like you specifically prepare a lot for every single thing that you do. And so you have this, like, you have legitimate work that you do. You have all this stuff.
Well, what?
When do you end up not making the bed, man? Like, like, what's the what's your crack in the?
I'd say he gets more personal than I do. Within 5 minutes, he'll talk about this girl he's dated and the bed he won't make and all of that. And I'm a little bit less.
Yeah, I was putting you directly on the spot.
I know. I make my bed every day. I could be quite
you
obsessive.
You do. Yeah, maybe that's it. That you're terrifying about how much you make your bed.
Yeah. No, that's what's my thing? I've got many of them.
We're both teetering on the edge of insanity at all times. Cool. Anything else about castration or any kind of like insight regarding having an idea of yourself and then not? Because if not, I think we can.
Oh yeah, we could. Maybe we should open it up to questions.
Cool.
And see where we go from there.
Great.
So we're going to have a roving mic, which is there's the mic, and I don't know who the rover is.
I think it's Aaron.
Aaron's obviously fallen asleep because he's like no one's moving. Has Aaron just gone home? Oh, there he is. You just having drinks in the back? Is that right?
Did you walk in just as we were saying your name?
I was across
the street. Wow, riveted. You were riveted by the conversation.
Yeah.
So, what's up?
Yeah.
We're going to do a big Q&A.
Well, I tried putting Pete on the spot to get him to open up about...
No, I want to open up. I want to open up. I don't know how to.
He really doesn't.
Yeah.
I thought I was going to like sneak it in like the side door and get him to really like, you know, but no, it's not going to
happen.
Well, maybe it will. We'll see how the night goes.
The night's not over. Yeah. So anyway, if you got a question, stick up your hand. The mic will come to you.
It can also be about anything. Don't feel like it has to be castration specific.
Yeah.
Hello.
Harsh word, I know, but I just, you know, it makes...
I love it, dude.
Yeah, there you go.
I love castration.
Hi. Pete, on the note of you wanting to open up, in what ways do you relate to the lonely mouse?
Yeah, well, this is, I suppose... shut up.
She went for it. Jugular.
Yeah, that's a bit much.
Kill shot. I know the answer.
Is that all right? Well, yeah.
No, I don't know the answer.
Well, yeah, I guess that's what... writers and musicians do is they're completely open. We all tell the truth. Like, I'm telling the truth there. I'm not telling the truth here. So he asked me, what's your thing? I'm like, I don't know. And I'm like, I've just told you this fairy tale that I wrote, you know? So that's a good point. I wrote these fairy tales, it's actually about 4 years ago now. And they were written in a very autobiographical way. Because the funny thing is, you can't speak the truth directly. That's the other thing, is that the most direct way to truth is indirectly, which is weird because you think, of course, in general discourse, the more direct you are, the better. But when you talk about the deepest things, it's indirect, because as soon as you speak directly, your defenses come up and, you know,
if you deflect something hard enough, does it bounce back eventually?
Okay. Oh my God. So,
well, you know, it's like Nietzsche, you know, says, like that.
So I came to America. Because I got invited. I think I talked about this in the last Fundamentalist. Did we talk about it? My patron?
I don't listen to him, man.
I don't know. Does anybody listen to the Fundamentalist here? Can anybody tell me if I talked about why I came to America? I did, yes. So I came to America, and you know, I was ripped away from my home and all of that into this wonderful new experience, but it was difficult, and these fairy tales were part of my reflection on that. So yes, there you go. I'm kind of like, at one stage, that was me. Yeah, there you go. And it's weird that it's only coming out now, because it was 4 years ago. So,
what about for people who might not be as introspective or into philosophy or have a therapist? I can imagine that there are plenty of people who start out maybe kind of fundamentalist, but they don't maybe experience the dissatisfaction, or at least not as much, or maybe their outlet is sufficient.
Yes.
And that's, I think, maybe a trajectory that a lot of people take. I'm just curious your thoughts on that.
That's good. And then, you know what? I feel bad because I feel like maybe we'll come back to that story and I'll tell it, right? But anyway, so in relation to that, this is my sister said this to me. You look a little bit like my sister. I hate my sister. No, we're joking. That's terrible. Leave now. No, my sister's wonderful. But my sister said to me, because I'm actually the only person in my immediate family who became interested in kind of philosophy. But she said to me, you know, like, I'm not depressed. I don't feel depressed. I'm not introspective necessarily. I'm not interested in these questions. I live my life. And she does, and she's very happy in her life, and that's great. The funny thing, the only thing I said to her in response, the mistake we make often is we think that depression is subjective. So we think that we feel depressed, like you, but actually, depression is objective more often than subjective, i.e., you often don't know you're depressed. So sometimes somebody can be depressed and have absolutely no idea. Now, they know that they can't answer phone calls. They know that they can't answer emails. They know that they've got like these migraines that a doctor can't figure out why they're there, but they don't subjectively feel depressed. And in that case, the person, one of the things that can help is to bring the depression into subjectivity, to kind of start to go, oh, maybe this is telling me something. My body is telling me something that my subjectivity, my consciousness can't tell me. However, I know you're not, that was my excuse to be able to say that little tidbit. But most of us, for most of our lives, get along pretty well. And that's great. Really, and Freud had a very simple kind of definition of when you need help, is anything in your life stopping you from love and work? From working as in doing creative stuff, doing stuff that fulfills you, doing stuff that you get some sort of like self-satisfaction out of? Or is something in your life stopping you breaking up your love relationships with your kids or your parents or your lovers? And if that's happening, then there's something to work with. But if that's not happening, then you're kind of good. Now, I'm more interested actually in how we apply this politically, how symptoms arise in societies, how we put this into practice in communities. But if we're talking about individuals, it's work and love. Do you have trouble with your creative pursuits? Do you have trouble with your relationships? Then this stuff might be helpful. Otherwise, it's going to be really unhelpful, actually.
Yeah, it can, yeah.
So don't stop listening to the fundamentalists, but just because your life's not terrible.
No, right? Yeah. Dude, I remember when I remember at some point, my mom is like a counselor for folks, and she, at one point, this is like a couple years ago, I remember her just being like offhandedly, she was like, yeah, I was like, you know, you're going through all this stuff. She was like, you know, just like, just watch out for like psychoanalysis. And I was like, what do you mean? And she was like, basically, it can get so in the weeds and so like up is down and down is up that like you can go round and round in circles with it. And I don't think that's completely untrue because
it's not completely untrue. It's not.
I do feel sometimes like I'm good and or not good like in terms of life, but like good in terms of like psychoanalysis and in terms of the Freudian stuff, because I think if there was a button like or a light switch that I could just like turn it off with and then like just forget, like know it on some level but then kind of officially forget it, I would like to do that at times, but yeah. Then the brain doesn't, it doesn't.
I will say one thing but and then another question, but is that I do think, and I could be wrong on this, but I do think that the death of God is a philosophical term for the loss of meaning, the collapse of your world. And I do think that to a certain extent, all of us need to go through that experience of the loss of our stability. And it will look different for everybody in different times, but and it's an argument that would be too long to go into right now, but the argument, here's the answer without the working out, which is to get to this place of peace, we need to die. To live, we have to die. And of course, you know that in religion, but it's a dialectic that actually to get to a place of life, we do have to confront something very traumatic, and in philosophy it's called the death of God, which doesn't mean the death of like belief in God. It's a shorthand for saying an event that happens in your life that just basically throws you upside down and gets you to question everything, and that you have to somehow not run from that experience, but turn it to good.
Good answer.
Any other hands?
Good question. That was a really great question.
Yeah. Is this on? Okay. Yeah. Maybe you can just give a brief answer, but how you guys chose what you're doing now, and what advice you would give to other people to choose what they're doing? Because I know, aside from this podcast, you guys do pretty different things. And I know, Elliot, you went to school for a very different thing from what you do now. So kind of like how you chose what you're doing. Yeah.
I didn't quite hear exactly what you said. What was the question? I'm sorry. So I heard the second part, but what was the original?
The original question was just how you chose what you're currently doing. Yeah.
Yeah, I did. I went to college for zoology, but grew up during and then worked at Animal Hospital for a long time, and then grew up doing acting, and then wanted to try Los Angeles, but always felt like I should do the entertainment industry in some way. And then I kind of landed in the YouTube world, and then that kind of the YouTube world was like a positive echo chamber where I didn't feel like I was growing, and also didn't feel like it was sustainable, and nailed that part, and then started stand-up as a result of that, and then wanted to also have like a return in some way to like theater and like that kind of, like, you know, I just love that stuff, and so yeah, that's kind of like why I'm I guess here. And then I read Pete's work and then said something about him in a video, met him, and then the podcast happened, because it sounds like, I feel like it's like a sitcom, like it's like a very like I feel like I'm living in a sitcom, and then that's, I think, where the podcast made sense for me. But you have, I'm sure, a much more interesting answer, because philosophy is a much more bold choice.
Yeah.
You also had to like invest in it, and you have like the doctorate, and you have all that stuff, which
it's a great question, because for all of us, I think underemployment is a disease. We're in underemployment, being that we're doing things that don't inspire us, that we have to do because we have to put food on the table, we have to do because we want to care for the people that we, you know, are living with, and we have to do that. It's very difficult in our society, and you know, I'm lucky in that weirdly I'm able to do what I do and I get value out of it. But being a freelance philosopher is a weird one. I still can't believe I think that's what I am.
Yeah, if you want to buy any of his god dang merch, it's
I'm doing all right. You're fine. I'll give you free merch if you want.
No, just take it.
Just please. Take it, please.
I don't care. Get it out. I'm tired of being reminded of death every time I need the Swiffer wet jet. So,
but so the question for me is like, what is? I mean. Bukowski said this, but he started to say, what is it you cannot not do? And for me, the writing used to be that. Like, there was a question I could not not answer. I was driven to think about something, to write about something, to express something. And I was able to find a space to be able to let that breathe. And so for everybody here and everyone listening, it's kind of like, how do you find a space in your life to give yourself to that thing?
Like, I can't not talk about myself.
Yeah. That's it. So what is the thing? And for me, that was it. That's how it started off. And then I'm kind of found myself in Los Angeles, and I've found myself doing this podcast. And yeah, it's a very
bizarre
journey.
Have like a fundamentalist. You had a spell where you were speaking in tongues. You were doing the whole rigmarole.
I did.
Pretty cool, man.
I did. From 17 to like 22, I did all of that.
Heck yeah.
So yeah, I don't know. Are you asking it because you personally have an investment in that question? What's your investment in that question?
I'm not sure what I want to do.
Yeah, yeah. What do you do at the moment?
I'm a software engineer.
Software engineer.
You're just sick with that. You should stick with that.
Yeah, 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 absolutely. How do I get into that?
You're good. Yeah.
So you're a software engineer. You studied at a university, software, yeah. IT.
Yeah, software.
But so where's the question coming from? What's the...
I feel a lack of creativity in my current position. So I'm trying to look for something that will... I don't want to jump out of what I'm currently doing right now, but I'm trying to also look for what will give me kind of what I'm looking for, or kind of like fulfillment or something. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't want to get old Tony Robinson in your ass, by the way. This sounds like it's just nice to Tony Robinson. Is that what his name is? Tony Robinson? Whoa, stand up!
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But, yeah, but it's...
Visualize it. Can you visualize it?
Yeah. Yeah. However, this is key, right? Is in a lot of my work is about kind of going, you've got to start getting dissatisfied. Dissatisfaction is useful, but you have to weaponize dissatisfaction. So the thing is to be dissatisfied and to weaponize your dissatisfaction. And to weaponize your dissatisfaction basically means to begin to allow it to make a change, make a punch in your life, whatever. And the first step is this step of dis-ease. This is the productive side of castration. This is the productive side, is the dis-ease is not necessarily bad. In fact, it is the royal road to change. So you're feeling this dis-ease in your life. What we've got to do, and if I was challenging you more, like how do we mobilize that dis-ease to make a concrete step forward, or two steps forward? How does that dis-ease begin to create a path for a change?
Are you saying dis-ease or disease?
Well,
or is it?
It's basically,
you're doing one of them things where you take a word and you make.
Yeah, I'm playing with. I'm doing a word play,
cool,
a
man.
Word play. Yeah.
Cool.
So it's disease. It's the dis-ease, and what you've got to do is nurture that, because what you'll do is there's a temptation to then go back to Netflix and just watch some shows and to.
Yes.
Forget about it and to just, you know, fantasize about what you'd like to do, and basically that's it. That then you don't do anything. So the question is, how do I nurture this question and go, right, how can I use my existing skill set to maybe transition into something slightly different? Maybe, for example, collaborating with somebody. The reason why I collaborate with Elliot is because that was an interesting collaboration for me. It's like
proximity-wise, it just...
Well, yeah, we live in the same apartment, but it's kind of like going like, and for you, like, you're interested in these intellectual discussions.
I love this stuff. Yeah, I mean,
and so he's collaborating with me because that brings him in a potential direction. It might not go anywhere, but might go somewhere, and vice versa. I quite like comedy, and I'm like, this might bring me somewhere. So is there someone you can collaborate with? But the primary thing in this context where we can't talk for a long time is that disease that you're feeling is your friend. Nurture it. Don't try to extinguish it. Don't try to let Netflix push it down. And maybe in 5 years' time you'll find a way to, you know, maybe you're neurotic, which means you'll never fully get rid of that questioning, and that's a good thing. Neurosis is probably the least bad of all the issues, right, you can have. I'm not neurotic, and that's bad, you know. Anyway, I don't know if that was useful, but any other hands, any other thoughts?
Yeah, thank you.
Now they're all coming up.
All right, who do you want to choose?
I saw this lady's hand, I don't know if...
This lady?
Yeah.
All right, you got it.
That was the first person I saw, so...
Hey guys, thank you so much for doing this, by the way. It's what you were speaking to about... LA being a place where men are trying to find the thing and women are trying to be the thing hits very close to home, because I feel like I'm having those conversations all the time. And what you, Elliot, said about you've read all these self-help books, I have myself, and so many of my friends have done this. We've read the books and it just feels like we keep having the same conversation and nothing is changing. How do we do something about that? Like, how does it hit home finally? How can we have that conversation where something actually changes?
And here's the thing, I'll throw something out and then you whatever. And then you do your thing. You do your thing about, and then this girl, and then I went out with her and then it didn't work.
Yeah,
you do that bit in a second, right? Yeah.
Living for love, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. But here's the thing, and like, I don't want to simplify it too much, but grace is a very interesting concept. Very interesting concept. Grace is and Paul Tillich talks about it, it's the acceptance that you're accepted. Grace is ironically the moment when you realize you don't have to do anything. So it's the anti-self-help. In one sense, self-help in its traditional form is saying you're here and you want to get to here. And we're going to help you, you know, do those steps. There's nothing wrong with that. But the grace is different than that. Grace says you don't have to do anything. You don't have to do anything. Now, the difficulty is, that's why Tillich calls it the acceptance you're accepted. Because what you have to do is you have to accept that acceptance. In other words, it's not enough for me to say, you don't have to do anything. It's that weirdly we have to imbibe that and feel it and actually like take it to heart. Now, the Oedipus complex, very quickly, you know it, right? Oedipus, this kid, wants to have sex with his mom, right? Totally normal, right? And then the father is in the way. He breaks through the prohibition, the father, kills the father, sleeps with his mother, thinks it's going to be wonderful, but it's a disaster, right? This is basically the anti-self-help story. Because the mother in this story is a symbol of wholeness and completeness, returning to the womb, oceanic oneness, the thing that will make you happy. You can be what you want to be. The father is what gets in the way. You kill the father, you get rid of the prohibition, you get what you want, and it's a disaster. Now, funnily enough, the Jewish tradition starts with an Oedipal story. Right? Adam and Eve walking around a garden. There's a piece of fruit. There's a prohibition. Adam and Eve think...
Sexy piece of fruit.
Sexy piece of fruit. It's only a piece of fruit. It's not an iPhone 10 or anything. It's a piece of fruit, right? But there's the prohibition. They break through the prohibition. They think it's going to be a blessing, but it's a curse. And just like in psychoanalysis, the Jewish tradition is, you will be like God if you eat the fruit. You will lack the lack. You will be whole and complete. And we think we have to obey that voice. But the trick is to exorcise it. In psychoanalysis, it's called the superego, and in theology, it's called the serpent. It's exactly the same as the voice that tells you, get this and you'll be whole and complete. And we have to somehow try to get, and grace is the technology to free you from that pursuit. But once you're freed from that pursuit, then you can use techniques. So in AA, the first thing you do before you get to step one is step zero. And step zero is just sit in the room, be honest, say your name, say you're an alcoholic. You don't have to do anything. You're just accepted. You don't have to do anything.
Did you see how excited he got when he started talking about sex with mom?
Yeah.
You're like, that was the one thing that made you go like,
stand up. I know. Yeah, I don't know what that says. Yeah. But that's the trick. And then when you're able to accept that you're accepted, then the 12 steps are useful. Then you've got the 12 steps, but they'll only ever work properly if you can get step zero, which is the acceptance that you're accepted. That, for me, is actually what a collective like this is about. I don't think it's what the actually existing church does, but that's what I think the role of church is.
Central Avenue Church, of course.
And Central Avenue Church is a place where you get that. So I'll give a good plug. I like these guys. That's why we're here. But anyway, so grace is a form of anti-self-help, self-help. Very difficult. That's what a short answer.
That's a really good answer. That was really good. I like that a lot, Pete. That was cool.
No, well, thank you.
That was one of my favorites.
Yeah.
That's my favorite part so far.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll take it from here. there's a Twitter account called Existential Comics, and it says, there's one tweet where it said, when you're a teenager, you think no one understands you, and when you're in your 20s, you realize you don't understand yourself, and then in your 30s, you realize that there's actually not that much to understand. And I think that's funny and true, and I think at some point you get to the point where it's like, I feel like a lot of the allure of self-help is it gives you the illusion that we're all these like incredibly complex, which I know we aren't, but like, there's also value in just being like, nah, this is kind of it, and then you're like, okay, and then I don't know if that's... or the death of God or something. But
Here's a good example of how it works. And this is a true story. Someone who was going to therapy. She was sleeping around a lot, going out every weekend, sleeping with people who are strangers. She felt guilty about it. She didn't want to do it. She thought my family would judge me, my society would judge me. But she was still doing it. But she thought, at least I feel guilty. Otherwise, I'd do it more. At least I feel guilty. I'm trying to not do it. Right. But then over therapy, the guilt began to diminish. So they got rid of the prohibition, the thing that was getting in the way. because they're going, like, don't feel guilty. If you want to do this, do this. But what she found is as her guilt dropped, so did her desire to sleep around. So the very prohibition that she thought was protecting her from sleeping around more was actually the very thing that was causing her to sleep around more, right? So as the prohibition dropped, so did the desire to transgress the prohibition. So as she came to accept herself more and say, I am accepted and it's fine, whatever I want to do, she found that her actions became healthier and healthier. And of course, she can still go out and sleep around if she wants, but she won't be doing it in the same kind of unhealthy, potentially, way that it would have been doing. So that's what grace is. Grace is the weird thing that says that, because it's the opposite of what we think. If I tell you what not to do, that's the way to do it. I give you more rules and more things to follow and more self-help guides, and that's what works. Grace weirdly says, no, you don't have to do anything. Stop. It's okay. And you go like, well, then it's going to be licensed. Then I'm going to go crazy. But it's like, no, because as soon as you take away the prohibition, you take away the desire to transgress the prohibition, and you become healthier.
There's a part of me that when you were like, no, you just do nothing, I was like, so meditation. I need to meditate. That's the answer. Got it. Okay, I'll do that. Yes, perfect.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Meditation's also cool. Okay.
Have we got time for one? What time is it, by the way? How are we doing time?
How are you guys feeling?
You can lock the doors. Don't let anybody out.
Yeah.
You can leave at any time, but we don't want to take up too much. What time is it? We've got time for a couple
we're
more.
We're good, I think, right now.
Are you guys, that guy there, he's got his hand way up. Or did you give the microphone already? All right. Well, whoever you think, you feel it. Divine it.
Coy.
Oh. Oh, wow. Perfect. Yeah, see, there you go. Thank you. I'm going to do my best because it's past my bedtime. But
me too.
Yeah, he's not lying.
Yeah, not lying. I get up at 5 a.m. I don't know why.
Yeah.
Interesting point about the prohibition thing is a lot of the countries that have done the best with hardcore drug abuse, they found that when they removed the prohibition, and that kind of helped the situation. But my question is unrelated to that. Has to do with Winnie the Pooh.
Oh, by the way, can I say one thing about that?
What?
Can I say one thing about that, right?
Drugs should be legal. Is what you're, okay.
In America, right, a very permissive society, right, and sexually permissive, whatever, you guys had to find a way you invented a technology to help young people have sex. And I think we've talked about this maybe, but it's the purity ring, right? You needed this technology that allows young people to have sex by primarily prohibiting it. And then you go like, now I want to transgress the prohibition and have sex. So that's the exact operation, is the more you prohibit sex, the more your kids are going to go out and have it. If you want your kids to not have sex, talk about it all the time. What happened? Where did they touch you? Where did you touch them? Draw me a diagram. I want to see what's going on. They'll go off sex for life. Anyway, keep going.
That made me sad.
I recently was watching one of your videos, Pete, on YouTube, and you told the story about Winnie the Pooh and his head going down the stairs and the bump. And so it got me thinking about Winnie the Pooh, and so I started reading the stories to my daughter, and she's enjoying them. But I was wondering if there was another story, or if not, you can share that. That one's lovely as well, of Winnie the Pooh that sticks out in your mind as him being a lovely philosopher.
That's funny. Yeah, no, because it's the opening line of Winnie the Pooh that I really love. It says, here's Winnie the Pooh coming downstairs now, bump, 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 on the back of his head behind Christopher Robin. It is, as far as he knows, the only way of coming downstairs, but sometimes he wonders if perhaps there is a better way, if only he could stop bumping long enough to think of it. And there's this beautiful image of Winnie the Pooh bouncing his head off the back of the stairs on the way down, which, you know, I thought is a beautiful analogy of life, is that, and actually, thank you, you set this up. It feels like we just planted him. It's like, this is castration. It's like, we're going through life, and we're thinking it's great. We're bumping our heads down, and then sometimes you wonder if perhaps there is a better way. Like, sometimes something disrupts our everyday activity. Something erupts within our life. It might be the death of someone we love. It might be falling in love. It might be losing a job, it might be getting, it could be so many things, but something comes into our life and just for a moment kind of allows us to potentially rethink who we are, what we are, what we're doing. And they happen very rarely. And a lot of the work that I'm interested in is, how do we remain faithful to those moments? Those moments when we don't bounce our head off the staircase and go, maybe there's a better way of doing this. How do we How do we show fidelity to the moment of disruption? And so that's what I love about that story. So that's the only bit of Winnie the Pooh I can remember, but I love that. So thank you for reminding me of it. Have you got any Winnie the Pooh? I don't think.
No, I always love the Eeyore. Pete, I forgot all my Winnie the Pooh stories.
Like, Piglet's obviously psychotic or very depressed.
Yeah, you're Eeyore.
Yeah. Oh, now I feel bad because there's lots of hands. So you make the choice because
yeah,
I feel
Aaron
bad.
Yeah, I would. Aaron makes the choice. Yourself of any.
I'm incapable of making choices. Okay, somebody.
If you have a fiver in your hand, $5.
All right.
Yes.
$10. I'm going way back. Yeah. I'm going way back down here to this lady. Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
I'm a big fan of the podcast.
Thanks.
I don't want to like totally put you guys on the spot, but I've sort of been thinking a lot about the relationship between philosophy and privilege lately, and so part of me has sort of been thinking like if you guys have any thoughts on kind of incorporating more diverse and like marginalized voices eventually into the podcast. But again, like I don't want to throw you on the spot right now, but if just maybe to speak to that idea too, like because I feel very strongly about accessibility to therapy and like to be able to have that zoomed out view of the world. But I do think that's different when you are not in a position of privilege where like that's even just monetarily accessible, but also just like when you are experiencing more systemic oppression. So yeah, I just was curious if that popped anything up.
I'd have to be slightly less self-involved before I let anybody share this mic. I'll tell you that. I'm sure you have a much more profound answer. And that's a very good question. It's very like meaty. And it's definitely a question where it is like indicative of, you know, the place particularly that I'm in where it's like, oh yes, of course, yeah, that's it. Yeah, and it like definitely is challenging. So thanks for asking it. I don't have a good answer that's not quippy.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that was very good. It's a huge question and it's a great question. One of the reasons why I'm interested in this type of theory and theoretical approach is because it's the idea of the truth comes from the outside. The truth comes from the silenced other, so the unconscious or the other that cannot speak. And so, for me, there is something inherently kind of like liberating about some of these ideas. Now, not in practice necessarily, but in theory. And I grew up in Northern Ireland during kind of this thing called the Troubles. And I was drawn to this kind of continental philosophy, and particularly some of these ideas, because I find them very helpful in the context of Northern Ireland. Now, I do want to say that will translate one-to-one into another context, like in America or somewhere else. But I find these notions useful in trying to work out the various issues that we were dealing with during that 30-year war. So one example is we set up practices that were designed off the back of this theory, because people go like, this is all very theoretical. But actually, I started off working with the community. My writing came later, much later, 10 years later. And you know, one of the things we developed was a thing called the Evangelism Project, where we went to be evangelized by, you know, other communities. And the idea was not that we would go to, say, the Islamic community or the Jewish community or the secular society, and we would, you know, let them evangelize us so that we would become Jewish or Muslim or secular. It was called the Evangelism Project because at a certain point in the evening, after we chatted, we would say, what do we look like to you? You know, what does it look like to be Jewish here in Belfast, for example? What does our community look like from your perspective? And then you would see yourself through the other's eyes and you would be evangelized. Like, you would see things about yourself that you'd maybe not seen before. So they were actually evangelizing you, not into, you know, necessarily their religion. That might happen, but it's unlikely in one setting. But they're actually evangelizing you to maybe become more human. and more thoughtful and, you know, thinking about a different perspective. So we had a numerous, we called them decentering practices, because it was a play on centering practices, you know, but these were decentering practices. Because actually, in society, like, it's decentering that generally brings about the change. Like, you know, you think of the Freudian revolution, that we're no longer, the ego is not the center of the subject. The Copernican revolution, the earth is not the center of our universe. You think of the Darwinian decentering, the animal, you know, the human is not the center of the animal kingdom. Different. So these are decentering moments that change. So these decentering practices, we're going, how do we allow the other to become an instrument of our further conversion? Because there's a thing in, like, often people think that if you go, say, do prison work, right, or homeless work, that we are good news to the prisoners. So you go, like, I'm going to go to a prison, and I'm going to be... So I went to a prison in Nashville. I was invited by some people who worked with prisoners, long-term prisoners, lifers. And, you know, my thinking is, oh, I'm going and doing something good. But this theory says, no. You do not go to the prisoners because you're good news to the prisoners. The prisoners are good news to you. Because the prisoners are not the problem. They're the solution to a problem. There's a problem in your society that creates the prison population. And that prison population speaks the truth of a violence and a fracture and a problem within your world. So you go to them because they're the voice of God calling you to a transformation in your society. It's the same with the homeless. You go to the homeless because they are the truth tellers telling you the truth of some problem in your society that creates that solution. Why is homelessness a solution? Because you take a problem and you make it concrete, and then you can arrest them, you can put them in a certain place, you can manage them, right? So it's a problem in society that is concretized. So that's what a symptom is. It's a problem in your body that you make into a headache that you can then take tablets for, right? So how can we create decentering practices that open us up to being decentered by others who are the recipients of the violence of our systems? But here's the other one thing, and another one other bit of it is, and this is the bit that we don't hear so much of, is how do we enjoy that decentering? And I, with others, developed a series of practices that were enjoyable. And you say, why should that be enjoyable? For a number of reasons, but one is, it is to be transformed and changed and enriched is an incredibly wonderful thing. So we had a thing called the Last Supper. 12 people gathering together in an upper room. We bring a guest who thinks differently, someone who is maybe an outsider in our society. We put them in the seat of Christ to say, you are God tonight. Tell us your truth. And it's called the Last Supper because if we don't like what you say, it's your Last Supper, right? We're going to kill you, right? So, and we sit and we have a meal and we enjoy the experience of decentering. And the reason is because if there's no libidinal investment, people won't do it. If you feel got at, your defenses come up. If I see you treating your mum badly and I say, you're treating your mum terribly, you're awful, you'll be like, no, she's a nightmare, she's mustard, I hate her, right?
She's but, mustard?
Yeah, it's a Northern Irish saying, mustard. Yeah, mustard. Yeah. So, but if I bring you out for a coffee and I say, oh, you seem a bit stressed, you might go, yeah, and I really took it out on my mum, right? You need a space to be able to come to know the truth that you know but don't want to know. So the question is brilliant. I haven't answered it well at all. But what I want is, how do we create decentering practices? Yes, as you're saying, to allow us to be decentered and in a way that actually we get excited about and enjoy.
Definitely a better answer than what I'm going to say, for sure. And I think I can only say, obviously, that, you know, I think I pretty much agree as much as I could follow. But I think, at the risk of sounding, you know, like a pompous asshole in any way.
Just make the bed. Just make the bed.
I think I should make the bed. I think I should just make the bed. I know that, like, I think that they're... Oh, I was having lunch with my coworkers yesterday, and it was one of my coworkers' girlfriends, and we got on the subject of the Louis C.K. thing and how Louis C.K. did You know, came out of nowhere, did 15 minutes of stand-up in the, at midnight, and to a at the Comedy Cellar, and it was like to 115 people, and he did jokes about how much do you tip waitresses? He didn't acknowledge anything, and he didn't acknowledge any of his actions, and then like yesterday happened where Twitter was just turned up to 11 volume-wise in terms of like nope, like he was like it was like the verdict was in and it was not time for Louis C.K. to talk. And I get in my head about that a lot, and then I get very like I can have all my ideas about it, and I can get very like you know like who where does the punishment go, what is punishment appropriate, you know, and there's that classic argument when you start talking about especially power positions, which is what Louis C.K. like the from what my understanding of it is that it was a result of him being in a higher level of power, and then using that in some way or another to gain what he wanted from people who were not in positions of power. So anyway, point being, it was one of those conversations that I wish I could have more of, in the sense of it was exciting because it was I was talking to this girl and we were going back and forth, and I was like, look, I will tell you straight up, like, I don't know. Like, I get very, I don't hate this guy, and I know that the reason I don't hate him is because I didn't experience this, and there's always that thing where it's like, you know, I hesitate to even say that because you want to be like, no, the bad dudes, they suck, and if he did a sucky thing, then he sucks. But then, like, I end up in this situation where I'm going back and forth with this person, and I'm asking all of these questions, and there was some dynamic that was established in the moment that allowed me to go, like, oh, okay. And there was a calmness and there was a peace there. And I don't know, like, I don't know what that means, and I don't know if it's, like, whatever, but I think that when, and this might just be my own personal, like, you know, strict dad, you know, upbringing, where it's like, you know, if you like, my dad would always be like, go get the tool, and if I couldn't find it, he would get very frustrated very quickly, and I would get flustered and I couldn't find it. And now I think, like, I'm 31, and if somebody comes at me like, ah, then I'm like, I don't know what you're saying, and I'm sorry, and I'm scared. And so I think that the there has to be, like, and I don't know, like, you know, I can only speak from my personal thing, but I know in that experience there was an environment where I felt like I was safe to be an idiot and safe to express the idiocy. In terms of this podcast and in terms of, like, bringing on people, the fact that this is happening is a miracle in and of itself. We're inherently lazy. It's amazing that we have a podcast most weeks. And if anybody listens to it, you know, like, every few weeks, we're like, yeah, there's not one this week because we didn't feel like it. So, like, there's not, you know, that's more of a work ethic problem. But, yeah, I think that, like, those decentering things, I guess you would call it, like, those moments where it was like, I could take a deep breath and not feel like my stupidity or my short-sightedness was being put before my desire to express what was, you know, going on internally.
Yeah, that's good.
Well, yeah.
By the way, I think maybe should we finish up now?
Yeah, is let's that, finish that, up, guys.
Yeah?
That sound, oh, yeah, definitely.
Oh, definitely,
one
yeah.
More? You want to do one more?
No, they don't want more.
You have one more?
Do a takeaway. Well, a two-minute takeaway.
We're done. Okay.
One-minute takeaway.
Takeaway.
And then we'll hang out. If anybody wants to have a drink at the back, we'll hang out. We'll have a drink. We'll talk more. If you've got questions, you know, we'll do all of that.
Cool. Castration is dope. I recommend it. I think you can read all the books, and you can hang out with a philosopher, and you can start a podcast, and you can go to therapy, and you can meditate, and you can journal, and you can do everything all the books say to do, and you're still going to be an idiot at times, and that's okay. And
my takeaway, relating to your question a little bit, is that there is this wholly other dimension in ourselves and in our society, the unspoken, the thing that we do not give space for, the thing that we keep quiet in ourselves or in our society, is the bringer of truth, the bringer of good news, the bringer of transformation. So if we can, in our individual lives and in our communal lives, create space for that to speak, good things will happen.
We're pro safe space.
We're what?
We're pro safe spaces here at the fund.
I can't hear that.
Pro safe spaces.
Okay. Maybe I don't know what that means, that I literally can't hear that. I'm just denying that.
Cool.
Thank you so much for being part of the first and maybe last Fundamentalist Live podcast.
Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you.